you know, investors say the same thing. So if a founder isn't able to listen and collaborate and engage with us, they won't be able to do the same thing with an investor either.
Hello and welcome to BrandTuned, the only podcast on branding that includes fundamentals like copyright, trademarks and IP that are core to creating and owning a brand that's unique to you. I'm Shireen Smith, lawyer, brand strategist and curious business owner, keen to discover the secrets of effective brand building. My guest today is Julie Barber, the author of the number one best-selling book, Investor Ready, The Guide for Startups on Getting Investors to Say Yes. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the BrandTuned podcast.
Hi, Shireen. Thank you.
Tell us what you do and how you fell into the field you're in.
Sure. So I'm CEO of Spark Consulting. We work with startups and scale-ups who need to prepare for raising investments so that they are confident and credible in front of investors. And I ended up doing this as part of the things that Spark does after 20 years in financial services, working with organisations like KPMG, HSBC and the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. And I spent most of those 20 years focused on strategic planning, global transformation and innovation as well. And through the innovation work, I spent increasing amounts of time with startups who were coming to pitch to these corporates that I worked with for either corporate investment or corporate sales. And what I found was that increasingly very often they weren't ready. They weren't able to put themselves forward in a good light because they didn't understand what those investors expected from them. And so they burnt golden opportunities by not being ready and reducing their credibility in the eyes of the people that they were presenting to. And I found that a terrible waste of talent and opportunity. So when I started Spark 3 years ago, although I initially started it working with corporates on corporate innovation transformation, just over about 15 months ago, we also started to work with startups on their raise preparations, bringing together everything that I've learned over the last 20 years, because I spent a lot of time pitching to corporate boards myself and getting money out of large corporates. So I've managed to persuade about 20 million out of various boards for big global projects. So I understand what it takes for people to feel confident to trust their money with you. So I took all those principles and turned them into what we do with our startups, and also turned them into my book.
So it must be really different, actually, working as a small business to working in a large organisation. I'm sure you must have had some challenges. What were they?
I think the biggest cultural shock initially is that you have to do everything yourself, because working in a fairly senior position by the time I left in large organisations, I had teams around me, I had, you know, admin support, things like that. And suddenly having to work out how your own IT works is a bit of a shock to the system.
Yeah, quite a sort of adaptation. Mm. Did you find clients quite easily? How did that go?
Yeah, so finding clients has, I guess, was mixed at the start. So because I didn't have the right network built up, most of my network was all very corporate focused. So I had to really work hard to build my network in the startup ecosystem. But you know, as my network increased and built, then the flow of clients got better and better accordingly. So yeah.
Mm. So dealing with strategy, presumably you understood all about brand and brand strategy.
To a degree, definitely. I mean, it's definitely from a corporate perspective. There's actually a lot of internal branding that happens as well as the external brand of the organization. Because when you're working in organizations that have tens of thousands of employees, you have to create brands within the organization to allow people to identify with things, to identify with particular areas of the business, those sorts of things. So there's this this kind of double branding that happens in organizations of that size. So we did a lot of focus on branding, particularly when you're doing big transformations, big changes of software, big changes of where people work, how they work, all those sorts of things. The brand that's applied around those things, the brand around a new piece of software, for instance, becomes really important.
So what does brand mean to you in terms of, you know, how you approached it for your business?
For my business, and even for the stuff that I did in corporate world, brand means resonance to me. So brand is a way of connecting with people in a way that resonates with them, that they identify with you and say, oh, that's for me. I completely relate to that brand. And certainly, you know, my brand for Spark is very focused around being the grown up in the room. So in startup world, there are so many, you know, young, new businesses with quite often inexperienced entrepreneurs who've never run a business before, who've never raised investment before, who've never done lots of things before. So our branding is all focused around, being the grown up, being the safe pair of hands, the steady guide that can take them through what can seem like opaque and difficult processes.
And how did you come up with the name Spark for the business?
When I first launched the business, I initially called it Julie Barber Consulting, and then decided that was too boring for words. And I wanted something that again reflected more of the brand of the business. So I spent a lot of time thinking about not just the startup ecosystem, because we still work with corporates as well, but the fact that at the center of everything we do is innovation and economic growth. And that when the two collide, that's when you get that kind of spark of something new happens, whether it's a new part of a big corporate business, or it's a new startup or a new product. That's when those two connect. There is a spark, and that's where I eventually got the name from, when I got that kind of clarity on those intersections.
And did somebody help you to develop your brand? How did you go about it?
I did the kind of initial thinking of what what I wanted the resonance to be with other people, envisaging, I guess, of all the characteristics of the business. And then we went through the whole piece around what that translated to in terms of not just colours and typography, which is the kind of very basics of it, but even down to the exact photographic imagery that would be used on the website or in PowerPoint documents, all of those things, even down to when a PowerPoint document's put together, what colours are used on which type of slides or for which types of clients, and which direction lines go in, because we're talking about upward progression and things like that. So there was a real deep focus through everything we did as a business to turn that into a pervasive brand.
And so you use your brand to sort of guide your business journey now, do you?
Absolutely. So it's really perhaps guide the business journey, but it supports it all the way through. So I've just been having a chat with the designer this morning, because we've got some events coming up. So they're putting together all the event visuals, which are all supported by the brand there. We've got a podcast that we'll be launching in a few weeks' time. So they're sorting out all of the brand stuff that goes alongside that as well. But it even converts into the tone of how I present content, and it converts into video as well. So I've just recorded a whole series of videos at the start of this week, which will be going out on LinkedIn over the next few months. And those are all, again, taking that tone of, you know, the grown up in the room, the expert, the person with the knowledge that can help those who don't have that experience yet. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's really useful to have a proper sort of set of guidelines that can guide you in every direction. Mm. So how do you go about actually helping businesses? What do you do for them?
We work with businesses at three different stages. So we work with either pre-seed, seed or Series A businesses. So pre-seed might be that they've got no product or revenue yet, but they've got an idea that they're trying to turn into a business. And then seed is they've got a product and maybe a little bit of traction, but not much yet. And Series A is where they've really hit the ground running and they've got revenue and they're off. Each of those three might be raising investment, but the requirements on each of them from investors are different because of the stages that they're at. So we work with the founders to help them understand what the requirements are at their level, to do a diagnostic analysis of their business as it is now from an investor's eyes and help them understand where there are gaps or issues that need to be resolved before they start talking to investors. And then once all of that's been identified, off the back of that, then creating the investment materials that they need, which is their pitch deck, their business plan, getting their data room ready as well. And also having an operational plan that supports, that will implement the business plan itself. So once they've got all of those things together, then they're pretty much ready to start talking to investors. And then we also work with them to identify the right kinds of investors and investor routes that are right for them and their company. So, you know, whether that's angels or crowdfunding or VCs or family offices, and creating then an investment strategy out of that, which is their timeline for how they approach their raise, so that they know exactly what they're doing throughout and they're not going to waste time and effort, which no young startup can afford.
A short break now to thank our sponsors, AsRights International, who provide trademark registration, copyright services, and more. Download a copy of its 7 Costly Mistakes with Your Business and Brand and find out how to create an effective brand. Details are in the show notes. Only choose people who you feel you're going to be able to successfully raise funds for? I mean, how does the fee work? I imagine it must be very expensive.
No, we're surprisingly affordable. So we don't raise funds for companies. We get them ready for investment, and then we will do introductions to companies, to investors that we know. But we don't handle the raise process for them. So once they're ready for those investors, we hand them over at that point and say, you know, on you go, and you're now in a great place to go and wow your investors. And we don't currently take any percentage of raise that they complete either, because I don't really like to have people feeling like they should take on an investor because I'm waiting to get paid. So we charge flat fees for our startups to do the preparation for them. And we start at just £2,000 for a pre-seed startup, because at that stage they've got no money at all and they need to conserve every penny. And that goes up to in the region of 30k for a Series A, which is far more complex. But in relation to the amounts of money that they're raising at that stage, you know, Series A's are usually raising somewhere in the region of 2 to 10 million, if not a bit more. So 30k is not a big expenditure for them to invest in their readiness.
And how long is the process, like a pre-seed? What sort of time scale is involved? What activities do you perform for them?
Sure. So we work with them for 6 weeks through a series of workshops. So we do one workshop a week. over that period. And then for a pre-seed company at the end of the 6 weeks, we give them our proprietary templates for their pitch deck and their business plan, and for their data room. And then they go off and create their pitch deck and their business plan using everything that we've taught them over the prior 6 weeks. And then we do an expert review for them afterwards. So that takes us up to about 8 to 9 weeks by the time that's completely done. For the later stage companies like Seed and Series A, we actually prepare the pitch deck and the business plan for them. And in those cases, again, it will be somewhere between 8 to 10 weeks for the whole process, with 6 weeks in workshops and then 2 to 4 weeks on preparing the materials.
And are the workshops dedicated to them, or will groups of them come to the workshops?
So for the pre-seed workshops, they can be in a cohort of up to 5. But for the seed and Series A, they are one-to-one workshops, because by then they have so much confidential and private data that we can't do that in a group setting, and we also need to devote much more time to them as well. So that's done individually.
Okay, and typically, what sort of businesses are they? I mean, without revealing names, what types of?
We work across nearly every sector apart from direct retail, because we've got no experience in that area. But we work across healthcare, across digital health, construction, finance. So multiple sectors that we work across. So generally, there's a very heavy tech bias. Less through our own choice and more through that's the shape of the market these days, is that virtually every company has a tech element to it these days. That's pretty much who we work with. They tend to be somewhere between 9 months and 6 years old as well. That's the prime period when they'll be going through that pre-seed to Series A. After they get past Series A, then they're too big for us to deal with.
So if you come across someone whose idea you think really sucks, would you still take them on? How would you deal with it?
If it's really bad, then, you know, we won't take them on as a client, and we'll have some upfront discussions with them about why we think, and we'll do our best to help them understand what the issues are that we can see. Sometimes we get clients who have the makings of a good idea, or the start of a good business, but we can see that there are issues with it, but we know those are things that we can fix with them through the process. So those kinds of companies we're happy to take on, because we know that we can help them shape it up and turn it into something positive. As long as they're founders who are keen to collaborate and to listen and to engage, then we can work with them really well. And actually, you know, investors say the same thing. So if a founder isn't able to listen and collaborate and engage with us, they won't be able to do the same thing with an investor either.
So what if you decide that somebody needs quite a lot of coaching on a personal level before they can be ready? Would you refer them to somebody else, or how would you deal with that?
Sure. I mean, it really depends on what the issue is. So if it is, let's say, a very specific problem with public speaking or pitching, for instance, then we've got specialists that we will, bring in as part of the team to work with them, that gets bolted on as an additional service on top of what we offer. If it's that, you know, there are fundamental issues in the business, then, you know, we'll do our best to give them some initial pointers and then ask them to sort of go away and work on that, and then come back to us when they think they're ready to proceed.
And do you advise them on branding, like whether they should, for example, promote their personal brands, because that's obviously quite important in business. To what extent do you discuss brand with them?
Brand is one of the things that we assess. And certainly with the later stage companies, so the Series A companies, we definitely do talk to them about personal brands of the founders, mm-hmm. As well as the company's brand itself. And particularly as well, when we're creating the documents that they're going to take to investors, it's really important that the brand is conveyed through those documents, not just in how they look and what the typeface is, but in how they sound and the kinds of words that are used as well. So there's a lot of, there's a lot of emphasis for us on the brand pervading through the words as well as the images. In the earlier stage companies, you know, often they're so early that they literally might have, you know, one or two social media accounts and a web page, and that's about as far as they've got, and they don't have huge amounts of presence yet. So often then it's more about suggestions of what they can do to improve their visibility and helping them to understand why brand is important in that, from building that consistent and powerful picture of a single company operating, in one direction. So it's definitely a subject of discussion.
And do you keep in touch with them afterwards to see how they're doing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, just this morning, I got a WhatsApp from one of our founders that we worked with back in May, sending me screenshots of their latest app development, saying, "Look, we've got the wireframes all together, and here's the latest mock-up. What do you think?" We definitely stay in touch with them.
Oh, that's great. So finally, Julie, which brand do you particularly admire and why?
Goodness me. These questions are always really, really hard because although I talk about and think about brand a lot, I'm not a very brand focused person, as in I don't go out and buy because of a brand as such. I'm not it's Nike, I must buy it, that it's Nike. I think rather that the brands that resonate with me are the ones who are very simple and straightforward in the way that they present themselves, and they're very transparent, and they're very clear about their goals and the way that they intend to interact with their audience. I don't like brands that try to be too clever to kind of hide behind branding as a kind of mask. I think any company that can use their branding powerfully but honestly and simply, I think are the kinds of companies that I resonate with.
So if you want to do online food shopping, who do you turn to?
Well, typically Tesco, but that's because it's the nearest one to me, so they can actually supply it. So that's less about brand, and that's more about geographic proximity. Uh-huh. A lot of it comes into service and proximity and those kinds of things instead.
So you don't use Ocado, for example?
Not Ocado now. I mean, we did used to, but that was for my mum's shopping, and again, that was better for her than it was for us. So,
yeah, I mean, a lot of the reading I've been doing for my new book suggests that, you know, this brand loyalty, yes, some exists, but people tend to buy lots of brands. They don't stay loyal to one type of brand for almost anything, you know.
I think now increasingly the you know, with with the power of the internet and the amount of information available, I think it's less likely that there's brand loyalty now than perhaps there was, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. So I think there's so much more choice available to people, and so many new brands popping up all the time that people want to try something different. So I think companies do probably have to work a lot harder to retain brand loyalty than they ever used to have to.
So thank you very much, Julie. That was great.
Thank you.
That's the end of the podcast episodes for 2020. We'll kick off again next year on the 8th of January, apart from Monday, when there will be another audio release of a previously recorded content. We won't be featuring any further episodes until next year. So I hope you have a good break in the holidays, and let's hope that in early 2021 we can put this coronavirus behind us, thanks to the vaccines that have been developed. If you've listened to the podcast to this point, please do like, share, or rate it. If you have an important message to share that would be relevant to listeners, then do connect with me and let me know. You can find me on most platforms, but perhaps the best one to use is LinkedIn.